ter uma noção sobre o ecossistema inicial, no eixo de redes, informativo de uso, em ponte, The topic for tonight is a very interesting topic, addressing some of the social, the health social issue that has been echoed by television and media, obesity, nutrition. So we're going to be talking about nutrition tonight. We have three guests, and we will start by having them introduce themselves, and then we will answer some questions.
I am Marcy Brown, a nutritionist with UW Health Pediatric Fitness Clinic.
I'm David Bernhardt. I'm a pediatrician at the UW Health Pediatric Fitness Clinic, general pediatrician and sports medicine physician.
And I'm Ruth Robarts, I'm from Medicine School.
Well, thank you for being with us tonight. And one of the questions that we have, should the schools serve lunch? Should they take their responsibility?
Yes.
And the
lower
parents, I think it really is
an
important
certain
the
learning
environment is
important for their welfare. Well, I grew up with a non-nutritionist mom who inculcated in me that, you know, your little engine has to have, you know, fire in the tank or whatever the image is. And so you had to have a good breakfast and you had to have a good lunch. And she was a teacher. This is where she got that insight. She taught kindergartners for 35 years. And I think it's just a reality, as you were saying, whether you're low income or middle income or whatever, it's increasingly hard for parents to always provide a nutritious breakfast and lunch for their kids, and it has become, to a large degree, the school's responsibility. Because we see that, you know, without a good nutritional boost, it's harder for kids to learn, it's harder for them to concentrate.
I'm wondering if we take this for granted, that the schools is providing this service, and the citizens, taxpayers, the parents, they just don't pay attention to what's being served.
There was probably a little bit to that, although some parents have, I've been on the school board now for almost 9 years, and parents have periodically brought us concerns about the quality of the meals. It wasn't that many years ago, probably 3-4 years ago, that we had to greatly enlarge our breakfast program. But I think, you know, your point that we take it for granted is probably a good one. Not only do we take for granted that the schools are providing the food, we hope that it's, you know, a lot of people take for granted it's healthy food. They take for granted that the kids have sufficient time to settle down and eat the food and some of those things. And I've come to have concerns about pretty much all those issues. I mean, one of the, our food program is like many, probably most public school programs. The food meets the official USDA standards, and so kids ate certain, you know, kids could pick at every single meal things that are going to get the most of the minerals and vitamins and so forth they need during the day. But, you know, some of it is still things that, you know, if you know more about nutrition as you do, or you're thinking more about nutrition, you probably wouldn't serve your child for breakfast. Our breakfasts are extremely high on sugar content and quick energy in combination with a very, very short time span. So one of the things that parents bring to our attention pretty regularly is the amount of rushing to eat breakfast. In some of our schools, a good two-thirds or more of the kids eat breakfast. They don't eat breakfast in the gym on the way to school. They don't eat breakfast at all. But the time for it is not often there. The busing schedules don't do it. The school starts, and so you see kids come in, you know, shut down part of, you know, a box of Fruit Loops, a little bit of orange juice, throw the majority of it in the trash and go to their morning classes. A similar thing often happens at lunch. Kids pick and choose, and they don't necessarily, you know, the USDA is not there saying, and so you'll take this one and you'll skip the French fries, you want to do French fries every day and so forth. So that one of the difficulties of, you know, trying to determine whether they're getting good nutrition or not is you just can't assume they're eating that whole lunch. In fact, most of the middle school and elementary kids are throwing away a great deal of it. And we see that in continuous stream of metal waste, food waste, packaging waste every single day. And, you know, I'm sure I know and you all know people who pack their lunches for their kids so that they don't eat the school lunch in the hopes that they won't, you know, live on french fries, pizza. Some of the things that, you know, could be part of a healthy meal if eaten in moderation and in proportion to other things, but that's not necessarily how.
And one reason that my kids want a lunch pack so they don't have to stand in line, they will have more time to eat their meals.
Just bring the microphone. Yes,
yeah, thank you. And I think that they're aware of the time crunch, and that's a huge factor, and most parents have been in the schools to see how rushed everything is. And my son is at Tokyo, and I stayed for the full lunch hour, which is all the middle schoolers, and then all the elementary school kids come in. Is it right? It's about 1,200 kids in that building, something like that. But it felt like there should be some wranglers on horseback, staying in Rawhide, because it was just in one door, out the other, and such mass. It was pretty organized, but just masses of kids being fed.
Well, it was just a few years ago, an organized group of parents brought us their concerns about the lunchtime, because the Center for Disease Control, I think the American Pediatric Association, there are a variety of, I know the CDC does, there are a variety of organizations that recommend at least 20 minutes seated eating. And we were finding that in the elementary schools, a lot of times kids didn't have 15 minutes, including leaving class, putting on their clothes to go outside for recess afterwards. And in some of the schools, kids were coming, you know, putting on the snowsuits in January, coming to the cafeteria, throwing in just enough food to, you know, say you're eating and going out to play. We had, one of the things I think of a lot, because parents have brought us both concerns about the time and the nutritional quality, is the ways in which all of this is connected to, or needs to be connected to, the whole program. You know, how much time is there for physical activity? How much, you know, what's the quality of the PE program? What's the quality and availability of recess? You know, even eating a perfect lunch every day is going to make you a healthy human being. There are a whole number of things you have to learn about, you know, physical activity and so forth, that I think personally are falling somewhat to the wayside because we have a very short time, particularly elementary school day. And we had, just 2 years ago, an organized group of parents and students at Crestwood School did a beautiful civic study where they came and talked to us about all the organizations that think we should have at least 3 recesses a day, you know, free play, preferably outside, and the best we can do with the length of day that we've negotiated with our teachers is maybe 20 minutes of lunch, 1 10-minute in the morning, and 10 minutes in the building some other time during the day, which doesn't meet even minimal standards for, you know, activity.
So it's not as easy as saying, yes, the school will take the lunch, just that there are some compliances that we have to meet, not only with the food and the nutrition, but also in terms of the time schedule for parents to have lunch and for them to be at ease and rested as they have the lunch. So that adapts to the schedule of the school's setting. I wonder if we can think, if we were to be in a position to talk about the ideal of lunch, what would that look like? I wonder, Marcy.
Well, I think before we go there, I feel like I'd just like to get Marcy's comments about, you know, if you don't have enough time to eat breakfast in the morning, and you offer the simple carbohydrate or high sugar content foods, and then you don't give them time to eat lunch, and the kids have the option again of eating more high sugar, simple carbohydrate foods, and you have a population that is more obese and has a shorter predicted lifespan than their parents, based on risk factors related to obesity, what does that do in terms of their appetite late in the day and contribution to them being at even higher risk for being obese?
Right,
good point, because if kids are not adequately fueling their bodies during the day, their hunger actually builds, and they don't feel it so much during the school day when they're busy and distracted and there's a lot going on. But by the time they get home from school, I think most parents start seeing the type of eating that occurs. They're really hungry and they begin snacking. If a parent is not home in that few hours after school, they can really do a lot of snacking. Then dinner comes and, you know, it's kind of a feeding frenzy all night long. So what they eat during the day really impacts how much they eat at night, and that food eating toward nighttime and then sleeping on it is not beneficial for disease risk and the risk of obesity.
I know less about the nutritional aspects, but there's been for probably at least 5 years now in charter high school in Appleton, where the children eat, high school age children eat 3 meals a day, I think it's all 3, at school, and they're all, you know, healthy meals, fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, and so forth. And what they've seen is just a remarkable school disruption, a big increase in the ability to concentrate. The principal gets on national TV and talks about how she hasn't expelled anybody since they started doing it. And videotapes of kids who at the high school age were having donuts for breakfast, Mountain Dew in the middle of the morning, you know, a cigarette and a burger maybe, you know, or usually not a burger, as you were saying, until later in the day, but they're having bags of chips and they're having sweets. And then, you know, when they went to a healthy diet, you know, they talk about just how amazed they are that they can sit through class and they can concentrate and they're not as angry and, you know, the skin is better. I mean, there's just a whole lot of major impacts that you can see in that experiment, which I think is offering, you know, not a terribly sophisticated meal, but one that, you know, meets the food groups and cuts down on, you know, some of the simple, you know, sugar and more sugar. I mean, part of what I looked at, one of the good things about the Madison schools is we do show the menu to everybody every day for every school. But I was looking at tomorrow morning when the elementary breakfast is Kellogg's strawberry Pop-Tart and fruit juice. The middle school one is cinnamon roll and juice and milk. High schoolers are the only ones who get sausage, Jacob's biscuits, and juice. You know,
and
those,
that's an example of how I think the numbers are crunched. Certain days it's just extremely high carb stuff, and then alternate days it'd be higher fat things, and then when you average all the numbers, it looks okay on paper, but those
The lunch is look better than the breakfast.
If I could ask a question of somebody in the audience, that's you, but Brett Huggins is here from Glenn Stevens, who's a physical education teacher. When you mentioned the behavior that you've observed in terms of, you know, this Appleton Charter School, do you, as a teaching group, can you discern possibly, or maybe you're not there over lunch hour, the kids who eat sack lunch versus the kids who eat breakfast and hot lunch in terms of behavioral problems later in the day?
I haven't seen the data on that, so I wouldn't know.
How about any personal observation at the school?
My daughter does have a hard time getting her meal done at lunch. She can't quite eat it all. I supervise the buses in the morning, and it's quite common to see kids get off the bus with a bag of Cheetos and Code Red, so Mountain Dew.
And this is elementary school?
This is elementary school. I'm aware that we, as a school, service probably 30 to 40% of our population with breakfast or lunch, and in many cases both. And so there is a need. But one of the questions I have is, within the federal, you know, the lunch program, I heard that the only requirement is a calorie requirement and not a quality requirement. Can anybody speak to that?
Well, I'll plead a little ignorance on this, but I think it does still have to follow some percentages for carbs, fats, and protein. But again, it's an issue sometimes of time, and it's in the elementary level that they're given a full lunch, you know, a combination of things. And often at the middle school and high school level, they have a choice of eating a full meal or going to the a la carte line, and that could be nachos or French fries or whatever.
I am aware that the school district has made efforts to come up with alternatives. A group came in, I think 2 years ago, trying to offer an organic lunch, and it didn't go very well.
And that is one of the, that's an interesting issue to bring up, because one of the issues is that in this culture we live in right now, there's so many options for eating whatever, and if a kid doesn't like what they have on their plate, they can just refuse to eat and get something on the refrigerator later, and that hasn't been happening in other cultures throughout history. So kids can be pretty picky now, and there's little to encourage them to expand their food horizons. They can just act up in a big way, and parents usually buy into that. They end up coming into the school system with very rigid ideas of what they will eat and won't eat. So it's one of those things that schools can't fix. You know, we can try to offer more variety and encourage them to expand, but boy, we're already working with a set pace by the time we get to kindergarten.
Going back to your question, Dr. Barnhart, we probably could go back and look at the kids that do have the higher office referrals and see and look at their records as far as what they've been eating for lunch. But I don't know if anybody's done that.
Because it would be interesting to look at what they're not only what they're eating for lunch, but what time of the day they're acting up and what time of the day they're getting referred to the office. And yeah, it'd be an interesting experiment to try and change the menu for those kids, give them more time to eat, and see if some of the behavior patterns change later in the afternoon.
Sounds to me what Dr. Werner is suggesting to us is that looking at the lunch, not isolated component of the school, but being integrated to the whole experience of the school day. So by looking at what youngsters eat, how they behave, how aware they are to participate in class, and how they take care of their own health. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yes.
So I wonder, going back to my original question, if we were to have been in a position to develop that ideal lunch, what would it look like?
I think I would rather, Raphael, try and frame the question, if we could, from a school wellness policy, look at the whole day from an ideal perspective, what would that day look like in terms of time for breakfast, time for lunch, and time for physical activity, not necessarily physical education, but physical activity. And I think there does need to be some time for supervised physical education, but in terms of just getting these kids to be more active, I think we need to allow more time. My worry is that you take your highest risk population for obesity, who are not getting a good meal at home, who do not have a safe place to be physically active, and then you go to school and you serve them less quality food than they need, poorer choices that they can make on a regular basis, and you give them less and less time as they go through their school career, from elementary school through high school, for physical opportunities for physical activity or physical education. Because as they go through middle school and high school, anybody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they have less and less phi ed class as they get towards high school, because half of the semester at least is devoted to health class instead of phi ed class.
There's certainly a huge range, you know, as you get older, you get, you know, some students are extremely healthy and participate in all kinds of extracurriculars, and other students are able to avoid, you know, virtually any regular exercise connected to school. I speak as a mother of one and manage that quite well. One of the things that I don't think I could come up with the perfect lunch or the perfect breakfast, but something I do want us to think about as a community is the Center for Disease Control has a thing they call the School Health Index. They have it for elementary, middle, and high school. And they've built in a lot of, you know, the science information into sort of do-it-yourself modules for evaluating, you know, the health ed program, the PE program, nutrition services, and, you know, right down the line, so that, you know, I was looking at what they, you know, one of their checklists for breakfast and lunch, you know, is some basic things, but, you know, variety of food, low-fat and skim milk available, appealing low-fat items, you know, what's available a la carte, what's available outside of the official lunch times. But then they go right on through the rest of the school day in these other modules. You know, is food used as a punishment or a reward? You know, is recess a punishment or a reward? And, you know, do those things, you know, denying kids who have acted out recess makes sense in certain kinds of ways, but it certainly doesn't make sense in terms of the need of the kid to have that daily exercise and some unstructured time if possible. I think that, you know, one thing I would recommend to all of us is not to try to become experts like you guys on the issues so much as to think about mobilizing parents who go through a school and ask the questions. It's available online, it's relatively straightforward, and it certainly brings up the kinds of things you see. You have talked outside of this discussion about some of what you do see among youth in Madison, and maybe this would be a good time for you to do a little bit of that.
Well, I think Marcy and I and the others in our pediatric fitness clinic are seeing more and more kids who are suffering from obesity and the consequences of obesity. You know, we're seeing teenagers who are weighing over 350 pounds and sometimes close to 400 or more pounds. We're seeing more and more type 2 diabetes, which we used to not see until adulthood. We're seeing kids with high cholesterol. We're seeing these kids come from families where sometimes this is a genetic predisposition, and sometimes it's poor choices and parents who are working and the kids making poor choices on their own after school and during school. And it's a, you know, when they come into clinic, our goal is to try and get them to live more healthy, active life or lifestyle choices, and do that through more education rather than putting them on the structured, prepackaged meal plans that are advertised on TV as the guaranteed way to lose weight and drop pant sizes in 2 to 3 weeks and probably unsafe way and not really learn how to eat in a healthy manner. So I think we see this, but you know, the disturbing part for me related to the schools is just sort of the, we're meeting some what I would describe as minimum standards in terms of some of the choices that the schools are making in terms of the lunch programs that are being offered and the time that they're given. And some of this is related to just the time in the school day. You know, you have to have a certain amount of education, obviously, but I think there needs to be time for the kids to eat or look at different ways for the, to herd them through the school lunch line. Similar to Marcy, my kids have either chosen not to eat hot lunch because of time or because of quality. And I have three, and there's one diehard who still will choose hot lunch if given the choice. But the other two have either chosen it because of quality or time if they don't want to eat hot lunch anymore. And you know, sometimes my sack lunch that I make, or even they make, or my wife makes, the lunch doesn't probably look any better in terms of the quality that the school lunches provide. But I think on a consistent basis, we probably offer quality, and that there is fresh fruit and there is vegetables in most of the hot lunches or the cold lunches that are being offered and packaged. Obviously, that's not the case for all families. But I think in terms of the overall health of our population, the school is one part of that, but you know, that's what we're here to talk about tonight. And then there's choices that they need to make on their own at home in terms of improving the overall health of our population. Because my worry is when these kids become adults, the incidence of coronary artery disease, the incidence of stroke, the incidence of type 2 diabetes is going to be skyrocketing, which is going to overall affect the sort of healthcare dollars that are being spent on diseases that are fairly preventable if our society chooses to do something about it.
So what I'm hearing from you is that through your clinic, you identified in a lack of appropriate nutrition for some youngsters, and they're suffering from obesity, and you like to get them into some treatment to get healthier. But just from that, you are raising the question, well, how many youngsters out there who are not coming to the clinic and who are not getting services, and they are still following an unhealthy type of nutrition? And that's a question to raise in terms of the public. What is happening at school lunch?
Well, and what happens, again, outside of lunch at school. Not too many years ago, we had lengthy discussions at the school board level about an exclusive Coca-Cola contract so that every school offered the same brands of nutrition-free soft drinks. We made a little progress in terms of not having only Coke anymore, and a little progress in terms of having some non-cola alternatives available in the schools. But, you know, to a large degree, unless we take this on as a comprehensive problem, we keep running into things like, you know, the school lunch program works pretty well because if you buy the stuff that from the USDA standards and so forth, you know, you don't lose money on it. So it almost pays for itself. The soft drink machines in all the schools, whether they're not in elementary school, they're not available to kids during the day. Middle and high school, there are more times where they are. But those tend to be the main source of discretionary money at the school levels. And so when you go in to say, you know, let's take this temptation away from kids, you have, you know, people defending other school values saying, no, you can't, because if you do that, then the teams don't have uniforms, and we can't, you know, subsidize kids who can't afford field trips and so forth and so on. But we seem to get into the cycle. The boosters clubs make a great deal of money for very good causes, selling candy of all kinds several times a day at the high schools by the truckload, and the same thing goes on, you know, at games. And so, you know, if our kids, to some extent, are depending on the school for breakfast and lunch to sort of get the nutritional cycle going, there's some problems there. But if they're then filling up on whatever's available, there may be some more serious problems in the availability of inexpensive, high-sugar drinks, particularly for middle and high school days, pretty much all day, every day, and at the game, too, if you come back in the evening. I recently was in one of our high schools watching, you know, the kids go to the Pizza Hut park, the other, you know, small number of kids that sort of had their own lunches. Very, I think, small participation in our hot food service, but big crowds at the booster candy shop that's open during lunchtime. Also, well-meaning, you know, educational resource officer works with some kids who are really troubled and tells them, you know, if you're good all morning, I'll buy you a candy bar at lunch. You know, this is kind of rewarding. You see it in elementary schools. You know, the kids are getting pretty agitated in the late afternoon. You realize some of them are hungry, so you have a little candy that's available. You know, I think we would make a mistake to look at this in isolation. You know, if people really want to deal with improving the health rather than contributing to sort of these unhealthy things. It's a fairly comprehensive approach that's needed.
Well, maybe we live in a society that we're no longer paying attention to health. And
although we spend billions on health, we all have running shoes, you know, we all have.
Not the hair is a sponsoring the running day, so what's going on with this? Why can we pay attention to what's going on with this?
I just have one more comment, sort of related to what you were saying, Ruth, in terms of what else could we do in terms of the school. And I agree that there's a lot of reward for unhealthy food choices, soda machines, candy rewards, etc. But I think, you know, if you're looking for ways to fund some extracurricular activities, there are communities fairly close to here where the booster club makes money by opening the gym early in the morning and allowing the citizens in the community to come in and use the gym for a very small fee. And they put on exercise classes in the gym. And, you know, is it such that these types of activities, I don't know the politics or the administration of the Madison School and Rec Department, but does Madison School and Rec, where does the money go from Madison School and Rec? Does that fund some of the uniforms and
that,
extracurricular basketball
that
programs?
Money stays in, basically, in
Madison School and Rec.
Yeah,
and
which services some, you know, very special popular, our kids during the summer, our elementary,
right,
and high school kids, quite a few people with disabilities of all ages throughout the community, but then also provides some extremely inexpensive adult recreation opportunities. opportunities. But that money all stays, some of it is tax dollars raised directly, but it stays out there. It doesn't, we are not set up, as you're suggesting, in a way that more adults participating in a program would directly benefit what we do during the day or what funds we have. And, you know, that's an issue well worth raising.
And you know, the question is, could you open, say, the field house at La Follette, the field house at Memorial, or the field house at East at 6 o'clock in the morning and have some type of an exercise class that is taught by somebody in the La Follette East or Memorial Booster Club or similar at Weston Gym?
We could probably do that. The prelude to that would need to be different kinds of negotiated collective bargaining agreements with the staff who currently, you know, open and close gyms and things like that. I think your suggestion is a good one, and part of what I'm thinking we need is kind of a systemic look at where are the problems, and if these are the barriers, why don't we deal with them?
Right.
You know, boosters complain quite a bit about not being able to go in and use some of our facilities when they have, you know, our kids who need the exercise because cost things and contracts are currently in the way, but, you know. Those are things that we control, that we work on every 2 years with the unions, and you know,
set
different priorities, you get different hours.
Right, but the question is, does a custodian have to be there to open the school, or do you?
Yeah.
And is that because of a bargain?
Yeah.
So a parent who's in the booster club can't have a key to the school and have a booster-related function without a custodian
that's,
in the school.
That's my understanding. Yeah. Same thing with PTOs in the evenings.
There are custodians in the building by 6 in most buildings.
Yeah. So. They're there, but there are also very few of them, and they're cleaning, you know, they're not supervising, you know.
Well, they're not going to be supervising a recreational program in that
way.
I mean, it's not like they're supervising when we, you know, when the YMCA uses the school at night for basketball practices, or the city rec volleyball and basketball games. It's not like the custodians are in there supervising that. They're cleaning some other part of the school.
But
they're just there.
And, you know, I don't want to make the custodian's contract sort of a bigger barrier than it probably is. We have 45 different schools. We have very different kinds of facilities. You know, the high schools tend to be more amenable to the kind of thing, or adaptable to the kind of thing you're talking about, than, say, the elementary schools where you have tiny gyms being used two or three times a day for, you know, different kinds of things. But those are good questions, and I think questions people ought to be asking us as school board members. You know, what kind of leadership should we be providing so that our kids do have, you know, healthier days, more activity, period, especially in the winter, you know, more opportunities. During the dispute about extending recess, where we made no progress, although the kids won a national award for their research, you know, you get flooded, if you're a school board member, with good ideas from other countries, cultures, counties, whatever. One of the things that struck me the most was a report someone sent me on the schools in Finland, where all the way through your ninth grade in school, for every 45 minutes, there's a 15-minute unstructured break. You can run, you can play, you can call home, you can listen to music, you can do a variety of things. Which I would guess contributes some to the peaceful, healthy aspect of some of those schools, you know, as opposed to just, you know, they're all genius, blah, 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 you know. There are other ways to structure kids' days, and it would seem like, you know, we're in a very extreme mode of having kids in relatively sedentary kinds of things all day. I mean, we still have the agricultural calendar from 100 years ago, so our kids I'll go out of the fields during the summer or whatever, but you know, the kids don't get exercise in school even as much, I think, as they did 10, 15 years ago.
So the whole topic of nutrition is carrying over to those who exercise. And what's happening in other countries, and how do we schedule the time for youngsters in other countries where you can choose to go only during the morning from 7 to 12 and then you go home. And there are countries where you have a choice. You go either in the morning or go in the afternoon. But going back to being creative in terms of fundraising, David, in the books
that stops the booster club from being creative and saying, okay, we're going to offer a class, aerobics class, 6 o'clock in the morning. I don't know, maybe nobody has thought of that idea. Us fundraisers versus selling candy at school. But then we do that, and then we have the middle school that we have youngsters being successful. It's because they're being successful, they're getting a candy. How are we doing the job there? So it's a network, it's a system here. How are we going to take care of our youth in terms of children, in terms of nutrition, in terms of exercises?
One resource that I'd like to plug is from the DPI and their consulting and nutritionist, Julie Allington, put together a really nice document that has strategies for improving the school environment, and she pulls nutrition and physical activity together and really has a lot of case examples from around the state, the people that are doing things well. And so I'd encourage it, you know, anyone that wants simple specific examples to go to the website. And if you put NE, and I'm not sure what that stands for, in the search, it might be nutrition education or something, then you get this whole document.
So it's the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction.
Yes.
So maybe one thing that a school could refer to be an administrator in a school, probably one topic that I would take is, rather than just take discipline alone, I would look at nutrition in my building, and I would look at exercise in my building, and I would look at as an instructor in my building, as part of decreasing the interruptive behavior for youngsters.
I'd like to put you on the hot seat a little bit, Brett, related to that in terms of physical activity and physical education. If we're trying to get the kids to exercise more, can you talk about a little bit where we are now compared to maybe 5 or 6 or 7 years ago in terms of the number of students in each PhysEd class and how you as a PhysEd teacher have to design your curriculum if you have more kids in your class that you're trying to get moving all in the same manner versus sort of Brownian motion where they're all going scattered in different places if you have, you know, 30 kids in your class that you're responsible for? Okay. Is it better to get them on the mic here?
Yeah, it would be better. Yeah, or you just grab that one.
That's right.
Yeah.
Are you on the hot seat?
Yes, I am. First thing I want to start off with, if a child doesn't get quality PE by the age of 7, chances are they won't get more quality in activity. And there's two studies out there that support that finding. Another study that came up was that girls benefit from physical activity by the age of, if they don't have quality physical education program by the age of second grade, so around there. If they have a quality PE program, their chances of becoming obese decreases by 40%. And that's an 8th and 2nd grade. So what we're not doing is getting them young. I think we're focusing a lot at the high school where Dr. Bernhard and Ms. Brown sees them. They're seeing the teenagers. Well, we need to get them in kindergarten and first grade and educate them there. And really shape our community's way of thinking. I appreciate that. Some of the challenges I see throughout the day are, I know it's like a third grade, do not have recess in the morning. And that's because of SAGE requirements or SAGE, the way that's set up within our school. Every last couple of years, when budget issues come up, they look to double up those SAGE classes in the kinder and first grade, looking for a ratio of 1 to 30. What I could do as a professional with a ratio of 1 to 30 would be setting up 6 centers within a gym, working on specific skills with very little movement. So that wouldn't attack the issues that we have that Dr. Barnhart and Ms. Valency.
So one of the things I have adopted as my teaching strategy, I have several things within the curriculum that I have to cover, whether it's dance, whether it's sports skills, whether it's fitness, just body movement in general, is that I kind of take a fitness aspect, a coaching aspect, and a PE aspect, and put them all together. Where I take, let's say, soccer, where if you've seen PE classes where kids are standing still practicing skills, they're not getting that activity. They're getting the skill development, but they're not getting the activity that they need. Within a 30-minute period, they need to be moving. So I kind of teach my classes within like a functional fitness philosophy. Where we were 10 years ago, I get that closer, about 5 years ago, we had at Stephen Elementary School, within the four or fives that I tested for upper body strength, 10% passed the standardized test. So taking my functional fitness, and my school and Madison School District received a PEP grant, and we put in 10 climbing walls throughout this district. And we use our climbing wall now as a functional fitness test, we have a climbing unit, and now we're looking at 30 to 40% of those kids are passing that test. We are making some headway, but 30 minutes is a lot of time. Another challenge that I kind of had, I have kids wear pedometers in my class, and that way I can evaluate what my lessons, if they're reaching a specific number. And research from Dr. Philip Scruggs from the UCLA Department here at UW says kids need 60 steps per minute for 20 minutes to be an effective class. One of the things that I'm running into is if I have to work on in a smaller space, those kids need to do that. If I have kids with disruptive behavior, those kids can't get those steps. To answer your question.
Yes.
So,
and I think if you look at it, I think your philosophy in terms of trying to get the kids moving is right on target, but you're limited by the number of kids in your class, you're limited by the structure that you have to provide to keep the class semi-organized, and you're limited by the number of minutes that you have to teach them.
Correct.
And especially if you look at sort of what is recommended in terms of the number of minutes of physical activity that most of us are supposed to participate. It's, in some countries up to 90 minutes a day. You're coming nowhere near that for most of the kids in our community who live in unsafe neighborhoods where they can't get out and play. This is their one opportunity to play. It's the 10 minutes they get at recess, the 30 minutes they get in Fayette, and the possibly 10 minutes they get in recess in the afternoon, in addition to maybe
get to recess they get by not eating lunch, right?
Right.
I mean, that's enough.
So it's really, they're not coming close to the, 60 to 90 minutes of good exercise on a daily basis that they're supposed to be getting. Now, I don't think the schools have to be solely responsible for that. There may be other places socially that the kids can get that, whether that's after school programs or the local Boys and Girls Club, or the, other after school programs, either athletically or socially, that can be offered either through the school district or through the community. But I do think that kids spend, 7 hours in a day on a regular basis in school, they should be responsible for, the majority of that at this point.
Well, that makes sense to me, and I think one of the things that school board needs to think about, and I don't know how the PE teacher who's joined us, I'm sorry, I can't remember your name, I think we probably need to negotiate a slightly longer elementary school day. Our instructional minutes just meet the minimum standards from the Department of Public Instruction. And so when you put a big push, as we have, on very small class sizes in the very early grades, or you put a lot of extra time into reading because we have, closing the reading gap things, the balloon doesn't get any bigger, it just gets squeezed in ways that other things suffer. And then we, in terms of at least money and public policy, we come back and we raise, tax dollars from the same taxpayers and put them in, school community rec and after school programs, the private sector participates some, but it's a little more disjointed than it would be if the school day were longer and we paid up front for, a day that involves a enough time for kids to be active, to have lunch, you know, to have an ECP program and be refreshed enough to have academics in between. I mean, I've become more concerned about the length of the day and the fragmentation of the day. And then, you know, the impact that you're describing for PE, for music programs, for a variety of things that also are very important to our kids, are just sort of getting squeezed out or diluted. I mean, you're still doing it, but you're doing it in a way that your own statistics, you know, are very telling.
Yeah, one of the things you brought up was the fragmentation of the school day and lack of time. And I think if we go back and revisit some of the things that we do, just this week, I was working with my kinders on, I call it object manipulation, but it's also a physics lab, putting a backspin on a balloon, how to feel going around your arm. So we can start combining subjects as well, you know, start collaborating a little bit more. We can take a geography, a map reading exercise and go out and do an activity called orienteering. Teaching kids how to read a map while on the run. You know, why not? Why can't we start doing a little more collaborative work that way instead of, you know, keeping everything separate? You know, math is here, reading is here, PE is over here. You know, we start combining a little bit more, and I bet you our scores look cool.
Well, I tend to agree, and I also think, you know, that I don't want to phrase these things just in terms of collective bargaining agreement,
right,
because that is really very far from the important discussion, which is, you know, what do teachers think we could do differently to deliver those good things they want to deliver into kids' lives? You know, we've got a little bit away from your lunch focus, but I mean, I think, you know, what you're saying makes a lot of sense to me, and an analysis by parents, you know, maybe structured by the CDC or by something DP. So we're not arguing for years about what are the criteria that I apply. We could come up with some ways to use kids' time better. And, you know, if we did that, they also might be, or extended the day, they might be able to have some of that time that they just simply need, you know, to play. I mean, part of what's going on in the school day is unstructured time. And I remember when we discussed it a few years back, one of the longtime fourth grade teachers said, you know, it's just critical to the development of elementary kids to have some unstructured playtime. You know, a little bit of PE down the hall for 10 minutes doesn't meet any of that, doesn't meet your PE need, doesn't meet your recess need, doesn't meet your psychological need to be on your own for 10 or 15 minutes and, you know, have a break.
We have to look at
where our kids get less breaks than we do.
That's the point I was going to make. If you look at how much time we expect our kids to sit still and pay attention, and think about how long you can sit still and pay attention. I got about 45 minutes, I mean, but I'm done.
We have like 10 minutes to go on, but it sounds to me like what we're talking here is not only the nutrition, but also the exercise of the country, how can that be integrated into the whole schedule of the day. And I guess the word that comes to my mind as we try to bring solutions is the word synergistic, that we can be synergistic in developing programming. It's not necessarily that the gym teacher has isolated from the history or from the math teacher, from the English teacher. There are things that can be done synergistically for the whole school, and there are schools that have been developed like that in the 60s, in the 40s. I remember a young man who started many years ago in the area of counseling, and he got into what he calls gene exercise in counseling. And he was developing that whenever he answered a problem, he would come to his office and he would make him do some exercises. By doing those exercises, he was able to immediately to solve the problem and releasing the activity that the youngster was beginning. And so if the youngster was not paying attention, by the time, after 20 minutes with this individual, he was able to go back to the classroom and was able to pay attention and to get back on track the class. So we're all here in benefit of the youngster, and we're all here questioning the structure of a day when it comes to nutrition, when it comes to exercise.
and not isolated from that integration of the school. We have like 5 minutes for questions from the audience. We have,
questions for each other.
I don't really have a question, but my last comment would be that I believe that Madison Metropolitan School District is, similar to other school districts around the state, responsible for developing a school wellness policy. And I think each school is going to have a wellness policy or program. And I think what we're talking about tonight in terms of what's the ideal school day related to physical activity, time for lunch, time for breakfast, the quality of foods that are being served, should be looked at in whole, not only for the youngsters that we're teaching, but also for the health and wellness of the adults who are teaching our youngsters in the school system, the teachers, the custodians, the nursing staff, the social workers, and everybody else who is involved. And I'm sure those adults need similar education in terms of health and education and nutrition. And my guess is they're going to be more effective at their jobs in terms of helping develop our youngsters to reach their potential, not only related to health, but in terms of academics. And if we could tie it all in and show that the extra time and the better nutrition among everybody in the school can improve the academic performance of our students and what's best for our students, then I think we can get buy-in, hopefully, from the community, the union, the support staff at the school, and everybody else who's responsible for teaching them. And I know that's a big, you know, undertaking for everybody, but I think that's where it needs to be looked at in terms of the development of this wellness policy at the individual schools and for the school district, is not only the students, but the wellness and health of the staff that's responsible for teaching them.
Yes, John, I welcome that message. It sounds to me that you're just echoing some of the business people in Japan, that people in Japan, they kind of hit at a special time for their workers to do some exercise.
They get
exercise.
More calisthenics. Because the buildings are pretty cold and it's often a very good idea.
The philosophy.
If they heat down, people don't sit so long.
And the philosophy is that you need to do good, you need well, and you can perform well. And I think that's a key word, that's a buzzword, that's getting well in school. Any other comment from us? Guesses?
So my only comment as a school board member is I appreciate your, you know, taking the time, all of you, to make some comments and to talk to people. And I want to encourage you to, in some way or another, hold the school board a little more responsible for these kinds of things. We do very little oversight of, you know, I know there's a PEP grant, I can't tell you about it, I know there's a need for a wellness policy, you know, it really, in many ways, would be a good time for this community to, you know, expect a little more from us on that level. I think that would, you know, if we're talking about what are we trying to accomplish for the community with our PE and our lunch program and so forth, that brings out a different kind of volunteerism, you know, the expertise of people like you, the expertise of our teachers, and you apply it and you get some ideas about how you might do things differently in the next few years. So long as we let these things be sort of administrative decisions made, you know, amidst all the constraints of, you know, whatever, I don't think we do as good a job as we could do of bringing out the community, both its concerns and its solutions. And I thank you for what you've contributed to that tonight.
Thank you.
I guess the bottom line is I feel like there's things in our culture at large that are an issue. We have a tendency in the United States to graze and snack more than we have meals. We tend to eat fast and eat mindlessly. I created a list here. We don't make mealtime an experience that's relaxed and nurturing, as it would be in other countries, European countries, for instance. We have a pretty limited range of tastes and food variety in the American diet. It's gotten pretty limited. We have way too much access to processed food and some of these hedonistic foods that are just good for the taste buds, but not much else. And it seems like the school has fallen right into line with that same culture. And it's, you know, can't make up for the problems in United States culture at large, but I think we could do something in our school environment to change some of those tendencies.
I think you're absolutely right. And one of the things you hear about the franchise pizza day is they don't throw it away, so we keep serving it. They don't throw it away because, you know, they did throw away the apple last week, and, you know, that goes on forever unless we make a, you know, very serious decision to look at how we eat, how we exercise, what models we expect for ourselves, for our kids, for our teachers. Maybe the Japanese have a better idea.
On behalf of InfoSchoolSystem and Atama, thank you for coming and being part of the panel. On a more personal note, I thank you for awakening me a little bit more in terms of how nutrition and how exercise make a big difference on our youngsters. And I'll keep it that way.